This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, hello, everyone. I'm glad to be back. My new abode, feeling very comfortable indeed in here. There was some feng shui involved in the creation of this this office, and I love working in it. I hardly ever leave it now. Thanks to Crystal Kelly and her team. She's really quite a social media person and a doer, boy. I mean, she came in here with a massive crew, and they did this. Okay, we've got a fascinating show today. After the flying saucers came, what happened? Well, we have a guest here who is a extraordinary expert who can tell us a few things about what happened in the recent years, and also what happened in the deep past. We tend to kind of ignore that. I'd like to introduce Greg Akagian. I hope I've got your pronunciation of your name correct.
Yeah, spot on.
Greg is a professor of history and bioethics at Pennsylvania State University. He describes himself as an expert on the abnormal and the paranormal in the modern world. And so we're going to be concentrating on the abnormal today. The paranormal is nothing to us. we're going to be flying over both countries today. His work has been supported by NASA and the Smithsonian National Air and Space Museum. He's the author of The Corrigible and the Incorrigible, Science, Medicine, and the Convict in the 20th Century, and the editor in 20th Century Germany, excuse me, and The Rutledge History of Madness and Mental Health, and After the Flying Saucers Came. So, Greg, I think the first question we need to ask is, are we all mad or not? You might actually know the answer.
Are we all mad or not? I suppose if we are all mad, that kind of means that we're not mad, because then we're all in the same boat. Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of an interesting question. I must admit that when I embarked on this project, I as you point out, I've worn a lot of different hats as a historian, and I've had a lot of different interests, but I have written fairly extensively about the history of madness, and how madness has been understood and dealt with, and how people who have been supposedly considered to be mad have been treated. I must admit, when I began this project about UFOs, I did not think that that world would in any way sort of play a role in this world. And then it did in surprising ways, not in the ways in which I think some people think I might think, but rather in the ways in which a lot of ideas and a lot of people who I had known about through these other sort of avenues of knowledge came to enter onto the stage in ways that utterly surprised me. And I will tell you, that's the stuff I like to do. That's part of the reason I took up this project, is I like to be surprised.
I'm curious about your taking up of the project, because it's a departure. I mean, you're a very well-respected and established academic, and all of a sudden you have strayed into some dangerous territory. It wasn't dangerous anymore. What inspired you to do this?
Well, the most direct thing was that I had been talking with a colleague of mine, a historian actually, who was working on a project that involved looking at the kind of revival of the occult that took place after World War II in Europe. And I was not familiar with that. I knew there was a kind of a flourishing of the occult around World War One and afterwards, but I didn't know that. And I had asked her, I said, you know, I wonder, do you know if this whole flying saucer thing took off in Europe at the time? And she said, I have no idea. Why don't you write about that? I'm like, no, I don't have time. I've got other things to do. And yes, we, you know, I am nothing if not a nerdy historian. So the curiosity got the better of me. And there I found myself digging through old newspapers, German newspapers to start with, to see if there were things in the 40s and 50s. And sure enough, there it was. But that really was really motivated by a deep interest I've always had in it. I was like so many people, certainly my age and almost everybody I ever talked to, whoever was interested in this, I was fascinated with this as growing up. And so it was a return. It was a homecoming, if you will, for me. And that's how I got there.
Well, in my opinion, all I can say is welcome to nerd heaven.
That's it is, isn't it?
Listen, free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a brief break. Enjoy these commercials. And above all, subscribe to unknowncountry.com. And subscribers, tell your friends. We need you. We'll be right back.
Introduction to the 2022 edition, An Awakening World. Since Communion was published in October of 1987, there has been a significant advance in how we understand the presence that most people think of as aliens. In recent years, this advance has accelerated steadily. We are right at the edge of official admission that somebody is here, and along with it, acceptance of this as a fact. But who? Or should that be what? When Communion was written, somebody claiming alien contact was publicly called a liar or pitied or being mentally disturbed. I experienced these reactions. Only, more or less in secret and to my great surprise, something else happened. As soon as the book was published, there was an explosion of interest. Derided and suppressed though it was, contact between human beings and the entities I had begun to call the visitors was not only happening, it was proving to be more widespread than anybody realized. And yet, due to social engineering of some kind, possibly originating with government agencies that had realized what was going on and also understood that they were powerless to stop it, the entire culture, from science and the academy to the man on the street, was being led to believe that it was all lies and craziness. Well, it's not all lies and craziness. And the way to find out more, and if you'd like to listen, go to audible.com and sign up and get a copy of Communion read by me.
We're talking to Greg Akigian. His new book is After the Flying Saucers Came, a really fascinating deep dive into just what is going on. And you know what I'd like to do? One of the things about the book that I really liked is the exploration of the far past. It's definitely in there. And you know, back years ago when we were just starting out in this, Anne and I, we were going over to Bud Hopkins's house and we saw a book called Passport to Magonia by Jeff Kripal in his bookshelf. And he poo-pooed it. He said, oh, that's not worth reading. And it doesn't have anything to do with what we're up against, which was flying saucers with very bad little men in them. And after we left, Anne said, we're going to go down to the Strand bookstore, a used bookstore in Manhattan right now, and get that book. And we might get two copies if they have them, because we're both reading it right now. And she thought it was the most important book ever written on UFOs up to that time. This was probably back in 1986. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about the deep past and how it intersects with the modern UFO phenomenon.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about the past is we like to think it's all gone away. and in many ways I think we and maybe it's a curious feature of Americans in particular, where we are always seem to be rushing headlong into the future and leaving, thinking that we're leaving the past behind. But the thing about the past is that it has a way of having created all sorts of pathways of thinking and behaving and feeling that we're completely unaware of. And we can think of that in our own personal lives, but it happens as a society. It happens as a culture as well. And so for me, one of the things that motivated this book was that, and there were many things that did, but one of them was to sit there and ask the question, how did we get to where we are now in conversation about UFOs and aliens? We're at a certain point. There's certain kinds of types of ways of discussing, debating, thinking about it, right? And mulling it over and speculating. Well, how did we get there? And when you start to unpack that, it necessarily then leads one to go back to, well, some beginning. And the question then you have is, any historian always asks themselves, where do I start this story? And I started with flying saucers. I started with Kenneth Arnold's sighting in 1947 as at least a place to somewhat begin this. I do go back further, as you note. But I start there because that's when a certain kind of way of talking and thinking about this emerged and sort of got bundled or packaged in a certain way. And that is namely this idea that there are these objects, that they are mysterious, that they appear to have a certain sort of form, and that we suspect they have to be something not of this earth. And namely, of course, as we know, likely to be extraterrestrial. That whole kind of repertoire, ensemble, right, of ideas and visions and all, struck me as the really good beginning point to then see how all of this then plays out over time and over the decades. As you said, I go back further than that to talk about some other histories that I think help to shape that moment in turn. But that's where I feel like, in many ways, the modern, this modern story begins.
Yeah, and you talk also about the ghost rockets in Sweden. And it seems to me that after World War II, something was broken in reality. Perhaps it started really with the Foo Fighters in World War II, and it goes back, it kind of dribbles back into the past. In other words, if you go back to 1850, you could find in Northern Europe a lot of people who were seeing the fairy folk, who weren't so different from the gray aliens. I mean, if you look carefully into the descriptions of the fairy folk, it's not Tinkerbell, not at all. Mm-hmm. It's someone with, a perfect example is a lullaby that says, "Go away, peery fairies, come down, bonny angels." And that peery fairies, of course, it referred to those big eyes. So that form was there, but it was kind of in the woods somewhere, and not in our faces. Now, right. Because of me, it's in our faces.
It's in our faces. It is all because of you. That's true.
You know, I'm a bad boy. I always think to myself after I pass on, if I'm going to start to try to ascend off of this realm, and I'm going to be pulled down, and someone's going to say, "Wait a minute, you got a little karma to work out." I hope not. I hope I did the right thing. But, you know, increasingly, the older you get, the more you look at your life and you wonder. But in any case, yeah. That aside, tell us a little bit about the ghost rockets, because something kind of fractured in the psyche. I think we begin to see something more clearly after facing death as a species in World War II, and then in with the advent of the atomic bomb.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And the thing about it is, you know, what my whole approach to this is to say, what I'm interested in is, and this is where I feel like my voice as a historian is slightly different than some of the other voices that maybe people are most familiar with who talk about this. And that is, namely, I don't actually attempt to ask, nor do I try to answer the question about the ontological reality of UFOs per se. I'm interested in letting the historical actors do that, right? Let them speak for themselves. Let them tell us what they think or what they thought, and to sort of re-excavate that and represent that, because we tend to forget that. And so one of the fascinating things is just what you describe, is that at the time, in 1946, in 1947, well into the early 50s, as this idea and these speculations emerge and these sightings start popping up, there is, in fact, a lot of conversation on the part of people from all walks of life across the world of a deep, profound sense of not just anxiety, but dread, and of course, a deep awareness of mortality. The scale of carnage, the scale of cruelty and atrocity of World War II, coupled with then this new device, this atomic bomb that had been a secret by one of the major powers, then sets the world on a whole new pathway that seems to indicate to a lot of people back then, seems less so now for too many people, I think, but back then seemed to be a continuation of that carnage, leading to something that seemed like utter extinction of humanity. We forget that. We forget that kind of sense of deep fear and sense of one's own mortality, not only as individuals, but as a species. I think is the key to that fracture that you talk about. Yeah.
Well, I remember it very well. In the 50s, I was a little boy, and we had bomb drills at our school. I remember how terrifying it was to when they would organize these convoys where the parents would take us out to a safe area outside of the city, and I had to ride in the car of another family. It wasn't my mother's car. Because it was just, you just stood in line and a car would come up and you got in, because the idea was to do it quickly. It was frightening beyond belief. But what's not frightening, folks, is you're going to listen to some really cool ads right now if you're on the free side. We'll be right back.
Who are they? Why are they here? What do they want with us? Why is it all so secret? All of these questions are explored in my new book, Them, in an entirely new way. What do Close Encounter reports tell us about what the visitors want with us? What is the military's experience? And can our memories be trusted? Can anything be trusted? Them answers all of these questions in a totally new way. It's available in hardcover, soft cover, as a Kindle, and as an audiobook, read by me. Get Them today, and you can get it from the unknowncountry.com store, signed by me.
We're talking to Greg Akigian. After the flying saucers came, a historian, a really accomplished historian, I might add. He probably was embarrassed to hear that, but takes a look at the flying saucer phenomenon. You are very careful in the book about the relationship between skepticism, doubt, and witness testimony. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to the phenomenon and to a skeptical but not denying view of it.
Yeah. So, you know, there were two things about skepticism. One was, of course, how I myself was to come to this. What framework, what attitude should I adopt to come to this subject? I knew when I came to this topic and to engage it as I was going to, I needed to think about just that very issue. And there, the attitude I adopted was one I've always sort of adopted, and I think, frankly, most historians do, about a subject, which is to say that, as I said before, you're interested in as much as possible to let the witnesses, let the historical actors speak for themselves. And then what you do is you attempt to try to situate them in their context. What that means, therefore, is to respect their perspective as being an authentic perspective on things, but to also recognize, and this is where the distance comes in, is that their vision of something is, of course, going to be colored by their particular place in space and time, wherever they're situated, right? So that becomes the key to the historian. So for me, I adopt a distance to the subject. And that is where, again, I say it very clearly in the book. My attitude, my approach to this is really my own attitude, which is I am not seeking to try to prove a certain point about what the phenomenon is about, or neither am I trying to play the debunker here. And that was that's the second part of this, was to do something that I have not seen done a lot of really in the literature. And that is to also say that skepticism and debunking also have a history. They too, as skeptics and debunkers and their projects, they too have come out and evolved over time, right? And unfolded over time. And they have adopted certain roles in conversations about phenomena like the UFO. They've adopted a certain sort of position for themselves that also needs to be, as I said, placed in a very similar kind of context. And when you do that, I think you start to discover some surprising things. I think one of the things that made me very happy was I recently was talking with Michael Shermer, the very famous skeptic on right. his podcast. And he said, I learned a lot of things about skepticism I didn't know about, right? I didn't even know where the term debunking came from. That to me was a source of some pleasure to be able to say, you know, maybe you can start to see the very thing you're looking at in a novel way.
I had an interesting experience with Michael Shermer on Bill Maher's show when he was on ABC many, many years ago. I knew I was going to be beaten up, but in those days I was so used to it, it just didn't care. I had to get out there with the story, and I had to just take it. However, I went into the green room and they were talking together and they didn't see me. And they were plotting, Bill Maher and Michael Shermer, about how to destroy me on the air. And I listened to the whole thing and formed my debate strategy based on theirs, and realizing it. And I have to admit, Michael did not do well in that debate. In fact, afterwards, he went rushing out of the studio in a fury.
There you go.
Yeah, so
I thought, had the advantage on them.
What do you say?
You had the advantage on them because you had been able to.
Yeah, because they didn't. They thought. I mean, they obviously thought I was a complete pushover.
Yeah.
Little did they know that the visitors are real and they weren't stupid about who they chose. I won debate. I was in debate in high school and college, and I won a lot of debate. I know a good deal about that. So now what happened after the Cold War was this unease occurs. And the UFO kind of comes into it. And we get people like the early contactees, George Adamski and the other people, and they seem like such frauds to me, like just a bunch of people trying to make money. Were they outright frauds in your opinion, or did they have something happen to them and then they kind of conflated it into something bigger than it was?
It's a really difficult thing to say. I think there's no question. In fact, some people have been revealed to have been frauds and con artists who are trying to maybe make a buck or become famous. It's difficult to say. The thing that you see that is common, Adamski's a good version of it, but there are others, like George Van Tassel and others, Orfeo Angelucci is another, who even well before the supposed contactee experience they had been quite taken up by esoteric philosophies, or I suppose you'd call them today, New Age religious ideas and worldviews, and had been exploring them. In the case of Adamski, he'd been already doing this for decades. And then the flying saucer phenomenon comes along and they see in it something deeply meaningful. They see this as, and of course we have to remember it, the millennium is coming to an end in 50 years. So there's a kind of a millenarianism in it as well that's operating. But they see in that something deeply, deeply meaningful, that this might be a sign of some kind. You might argue, I've seen people make the argument that people like Adamski and Angelucci and others maybe actually had an experience. But what happened is that experience was then quickly folded into that worldview. And then they sort of ran with it. And then it became bigger than that event, right? That kind of thing took place. That's the most, probably one of the more generous viewpoints that people hold about it.
That is generous. Yeah. But I'm in the same boat. Bud Hopkins and Dave Jacobs would have said, that happened to me. That basically I had a horrible experience, which I certainly did. I mean, there's nothing like a rectal probe to make your evening. Believe me. And, I was in shock for days and then struggled with PTSD without really knowing I had it for a couple of years afterwards, including during the Communion author tour, which was made it all very, very difficult. But Bud and Dave feel that this is an intrusion into human experience by a physical presence that has some kind of a negative agenda that involves exploiting us. I see this as an initiatory experience, whether that's true or not. How do you kind of respond to that combination of sort of disparate but curiously linked attitudes?
Yeah, I mean, that to me has been one of the more fascinating and also head-scratchingly difficult set of speculations and theorizings that I've had to sort of grapple with in this. I mean, the thing that's interesting to me is that even before that point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when I read Communion, especially that period of time in your writing and your newsletter and things like that from that time, it strikes me that you are not just simply folding this into a ready-made ideology or philosophy. You're searching, and there's a lot of, I see you experimenting in Communion with a lot of different ideas. I love the sections where you go through different variations on the theme and just think about what might be possible. That whole conversation that divide between, yes, Hopkins and Jacobs on one hand, with this sort of, yes, physical reality, invaders bent on colonizing us and conquest, versus your voice. I think John Mack's voice was similar to yours. I think Leo Sprinkle, as I talk about in the book, was one who was articulating that even earlier than just about anybody, because he was starting to discuss this already back in the late 60s, early 70s. So it seemed to me that what you had was this sense that everybody agreed something that is deeply, deeply shocking and traumatizing is occurring. But then what you have is this sense of where do we go from there as individuals, but then obviously as a community talking about this. And that struck me as the intriguing thing for me to sort of look at more carefully. The consequences of what happens when you go down one pathway versus another pathway. The pathway that you adopt and John Mack adopted versus the pathway that Dave Jacobs and Bud Hopkins adopted. And the kinds of ways in which people find meaning in those. That strikes me as a deeply human venture, right? As one where you end up having to explore a lot about yourself, right? Not just about the experiences, but yourself as well.
Yeah, you sure do, because you get, in my case, in the early contactee stories, there is, I don't recall exactly which ones, maybe yours, but they have stories of sex with beautiful blonde bombshells from Venus and whatnot. And I had that experience too, but it was no blonde bombshell. Mm. It was a very, very difficult experience. And yet it seems to me to have been real in some way. Jeff Kripal, in the book we wrote together, Supernatural, has a very interesting take on it. He says that he thinks that it was Anne in kind of another sort of supernatural form. Mm. Because, and he draws that conclusion. It's not really a conclusion. It's sort of an exploration of a possibility from the fact that Anne was so completely indifferent to it. I was so ashamed when I told her about it. I thought, you know, I'm such a stick in the mud when it comes to oaths and things and lies. I can't do that. I can't break a vow. It's inconceivable. Mm. And yet I did. And she said, well, it wasn't your fault. I said, well, there was nothing I could do about it, but I'm so ashamed, honey. And I apologize. She said something along the lines of, well, let her come in and apologize. And she was just blew it off.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what is going on here? Because where I'm going here with this is, and I'm not sure it's I'm fairly sure it's a path you want to go down at least a little ways. What is the relationship, the real relationship between us and them? Because it's so intimate. It seems so dangerous, so beautiful, wrapped up into one. John Mack and I are on one side of the fence. Yeah. Bud and Dave are on another. But shouldn't we all be in the same house?
Yeah.
In different rooms?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in some sense, yeah, you could say that. But once again, this is who we are, human beings. This is what one of the things history shows us. We can all have, or at least some share of the human race can have similar kinds of experiences, and yet come away from them with very different perspectives on them. And to me, when we use that as an opportunity to share and to converse and to exchange ideas in a civil manner, then it's actually, to me, one of the wonderful things about a human being and humanity. It's one of the things that I've mentioned this to Jeff Kribel before, that to me is one of the things that makes the human story, the human history of these kinds of encounters, to me, really, really fascinating, but also instructive for us. Now, of course, not everybody does that, right? Not everybody comes away feeling that the differences make us better, maybe give us a bigger picture than we'd otherwise have, right? Some people see it as, well, no, it's time to set up turf. It's time to set up boundaries, and there's you, and there's us, and it's them. That's when I think things get unfortunate. And so I agree with you, yeah.
Well, in that case, politics is sort of basically unfortunate. You know what we're going to do, folks? We're going to take a final break for our free side. We'll be right back.
Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
This is Whitley Strieber. Listen to me now from June of 2010, talking to Alan Lammers about an incredible thing that happened to him on the island of Sulawesi in Indonesia.
Here you are in South Sulawesi in the little town in the district of Sandu Batu. What happened? You were told something rather strange.
Well, we were told before we went, like my friends that I work with with the NGO, they told me that when you pack, because it kind of happened by accident, I went out to buy a raincoat. It rains quite a bit in this part of the world. And so I went out and I bought a yellow raincoat. And my friend said, I'm sorry, you can't take that to Walla Walla. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, you can't wear that color. So anyways, excuse me. So I thought, okay, well, what colors can I wear? They said, well, you can only wear black or white. You cannot wear any bright colors, no bright green, especially no yellow. And, you know, that's all you should bring. And I said, well, what would happen? And they said, well, people disappear.
You will find the rest of that story, and it is brain-bending, in the June 5th edition of Dreamland, June 5, 2010 edition of Dreamland in the unknowncountry.com archive. This archive is one of the richest of its kind in the world, probably is the richest of its kind in the world, filled with extraordinary shows, of which this show is certainly one, this show with Alan Lammers. You will never have heard anything like it. It does what Dreamland is here to do. It opens your mind to the fact that we live inside a hidden reality that we prefer not to acknowledge, but not here. Here on unknowncountry.com, we do acknowledge it. We live in it and we love it. Subscribe today. You can't go wrong. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and get started. We're talking to Greg Ekhigian. His new deep dive into the UFO phenomenon, very nuanced and very different from the books you might be seeing out there, which are coming in increasing numbers, all too many of which have the flavor of AI in the writing. And they're being written very quickly And this is not the case with after the flying saucers came. This is something you can really learn from. And it's also fascinating because, Greg, you tell a good story.
Oh, good. That's a compliment coming from a great story writer. So thank you.
Well, yeah, a great story. Yeah, that's another reason they pick me, I think, is because I'm a good storyteller. You know, when I was a boy in Texas, we had a tradition. It's sort of like everything. The old Texas has kind of been swept away. But in the Texas I grew up, there were tall tales. And Texans prided themselves on their ability to tell tall tales. My dad was a master of the tall tale. And when I was a young man, I used to tell tall tales too. And then a tall tale actually happened to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I couldn't tell any fake tall tales anymore. But then again, I didn't need to either, did I? Because I had my own real tall tale. Now, I want to get on to the difference, and you discuss this, and it's quite fascinating. I don't know of any book that's ever discussed this before, the difference between the approaches of European UFO researchers and American UFO researchers, which were quite striking to me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Sure. I mean, one of the things that was, I knew I was going to have to do with this book was to talk about something that rarely gets talked about. And that's to look at the international, the global scale, not just of sightings, but of the way in which people have built up groups and organizations and written about this and organized conferences and meetings to discuss and analyze cases. I was going to need to do that. And so one of the things that you see, as you point out, is that there are different parts of the world outside of the United States that are deeply invested in this question. One area was South America, but the other was Europe. And the Europeans, you know, one of the things you got to keep in mind is when the flying saucer sightings start happening, and that includes the ghost rockets in 1946, for a lot of Europeans, this is very, very scary stuff because, you know, aerial bombing and destruction of cities from the skies was not just some sort of thing that they had to conjure up in their imagination. It was in their memories, very recent history in the late 40s and early 50s. And so there's a lot of interest in this subject, and they too start creating groups and organizations, and you start having ufology researchers emerging already in the mid-1950s. Some of them going to go on to become quite famous, right? Aimé Michel probably being one of the early ones, and Jacques Vallée is certainly influenced by a lot of those folks. But the Europeans by the 60s, 70s, and 80s start to really develop this idea that maybe the way to start understanding the phenomenon is to see it in relationship to psychology, human psychology, and human culture and history. And so they start doing deep dives into history, into psychological research. And for some of them, it's going to lead them more into the direction of a kind of a skepticism. For others, it's not going to lead them into skepticism so much as it's going to lead them into say that maybe the key to understanding all this doesn't lie in, you know, better instruments and in government investigations, but it lies really in exploring our human subjectivity, how we think, our consciousness. And so in a sense, it leads them to look more inward. And I think that's a key moment that has an impact back then in the United States, and other people then in the US start to take that up. So that by the 70s and 80s, really, the Europeans start to have a very different take on things, and there's some really interesting moments when you look at some of their meetings in the 80s, and they're like, you know, we don't understand the Americans anymore and what they're up to, because this doesn't map onto the way that we have started to think about how to approach the subject.
The abduction phenomenon isn't, or the, and I should say, let me speak more broadly. The close encounter phenomenon isn't very present in Europe, right, but it is in the in North and South America, in,
right,
and very different in the two areas. In North America, you find abduction stories. People are taken, things are done to them, they're brought back. In South America, it's a much more violent situation where people will be walking down a path and they'll suddenly be followed by something that starts to shoot beams of light at them. People are injured. People are terrified. They're made sick. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different ball of wax. It's like in North America, one group of, if you will, aliens is abducting people in a very organized way. And in South America, they're like hunting them and terrorizing them. Yeah. Why is it like that? And then in Europe, it's hardly happening at all.
Yeah, or when it does happen, it plays out in unusual ways. I mean, the thing that you get with a lot of the Europeans was you do get a lot of stories about, you know, as I talk about in the book, little men encounters. And then, you know, you even get some of these encounters in, when I looked at other parts of the world, like Malaysia, there's discussion that in fact, most of the encounters are with beings who are less than a foot tall. They're many of them are just 6 inches high. Right. So that you do seem to see this. My own take on this is that, and this is where I think more research needs to be done by people who understand these cultural dimensions of things. But this seems to me, again, to be the nature of how we humans deal with any kind of anomalous phenomenon, or even things that are not anomalous, but just simply mundane. And that is, we can only sort of understand and perceive the world through that cultural and social lens that exists for us. So I tend to see these things as not undermining people's experiences, but what they do is they're cast in a certain light and can be sort of remembered and then recounted in ways that fit into existing sort of, as I like to often call it, an existing repertoire of ideas and feelings and narratives. Because I think the thing that one does see consistently among people in history who've talked about encounters in certain ways is you tend to see this sense that I can't quite get my words together to describe this. I can't quite remember everything that happened, right? I'm fumbling for the ideas and the concepts to make sense of this. That's where I think you start to see human beings having to rely on those resources that you have readily available to you, whether that's your personality, whether that's your family upbringing, whether that's your culture. That to me seems to me that human dimension that always has to play a role. Why would it not play a role? You know, that's the way I kind of see it.
Interestingly enough, in Indonesia, the culture has, there are quite a few different, very, very small beings that are in the mystical, in the supernatural tradition in that country, including one group that is now being thought to actually be real, which were known as the Orang Tanda. I wrote a novel some years ago about them. This happens with so too many of my books. Now there are scientists who think they might actually be a subspecies, a very small human subspecies. Huh. Now, what's fascinating about this is in the West, in the United States, we're very tall by comparison, say, to Indonesians. Their aliens are very small. Mm-hmm. Our aliens tend to be very tall. We have the Nordics. We have the tall whites. Actually, one of the smaller species is the grays, who are 5 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And then the little dwarfs that are near them are separate. But there's some kind of strange reflectivity here. Mm-hmm. And I think it has something to do not with necessarily what's actually there in mm-hmm. some objective way, but the way we see through the lens of our culture and our expectations. How do you, I know you address this sort of indirectly in the book. We're going to get on to abductions in just a minute, but maybe this is too vague a question. If it is, we'll go on. But do you have a response to that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. I mean, there's a very famous adage in the world of clinical psychology that used to be about the nature of dream interpretation in psychoanalysis, and made the point. Somebody once coined the term or the adage: Freudians have Freudian dreams. Jungians have Jungian dreams, right? That one's dreams tend to sort of replicate that kind of understanding you have of your own dreams. And so Freudian patients have Freudian dreams and Jungian patients have Jungian dreams. I think there's something absolutely to this idea that this reflexivity, that there's a give and take going on here between the experience and then the way in which people come to the experience, but also then, if in a sense, inhabit that experience, right? And it inhabits you. It's going to reside inside all of that world, that ecosystem that is your own sort of consciousness. It seems to me almost inevitable that we are going to play a role in all of that as well.
I can certainly see that, and we do. I mean, we do play a role in structuring what we see. And I wouldn't be surprised if nobody's ever actually seen in an objective way what's there.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the history of the planet, quite possibly. And unfortunately, we can't know that. It's just a kind of theory, because we never see anything really, as so many idealists, I believe they're called, point mm-hmm. out. We can only react to what our senses deliver to us. And there's a whole very complex set of studies about how the brain organizes experience. And for example, when you're looking at something, your brain, you'd think, well, your brain was primarily occupied with the optics, the optic nerve, but it's not. It's really looking mostly into its own memory for comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
You can't make some sense of something that you can't make comparisons. Okay, we have come to the end of our time with our free side. We're going to go into some fascinating subjects. We're going to go into the abductions. We're going to go into the government and the military and their struggles and technological changes that may have come out of this, and also the technologies that we are trying to use to study it. So we've got a lot to go yet. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being with us on Dreamland.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.